KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for listening in today. Today, I'm very excited to have on the co-author of the book, The Social Life of Information, Paul Duguid. Paul is a professor and an adjunct professor at the Berkeley School of Information, and I'll allow him to give himself a longer introduction as necessary. But his book, which I'll call it his book for purposes of our conversation, even though it is co-authored with John Seely Brown, is one of the early analyses, and by early in the technology world, we're talking about the year 2000, early analyses of a culture and a technological culture that is ultimately one that is full of flowery predictions about wonderful outcomes as well as doom and gloom. And what Paul's book does in a very detailed and very thoughtful way is take a step back from all of the predictions to take a clear look at what it is that we have in technology. The Social Life of Information, which is the title of the book, really sets the stage for what the conversation is going to be today. It's really going to be a discussion of the impact of these technologies and indeed how they are designed and whether those design structures are appropriate for the world that we live in. I'm going to quote from the preface in the updated version of the book, which came out in 2002. And quoting the preface, Paul and John wrote, "If we keep looking down the same tunnel, we are likely to keep encountering the same problems. To avoid them, this book argues, we all need to get outside the information tunnel, look around, and appreciate the social life that lies beyond and makes it possible." So unlike some of the people I've interviewed today, Paul's view of the technology is very much made and done through the prism of the social impact of information and its very life. So when we return from the music break, we will have a discussion with Professor Paul Duguid, the co-author of the book, The Social Life of Information. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU, Stanford. If I've done my job properly, on the other end of the line is Paul. Paul, are you there?
I am indeed.
Terrific. Well, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. And let's jump right in and talk about the title of the book. So the name of the book, why you came up with that name and the general thesis.
Okay, before jumping right in, let me just thanks very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
And then I'll jump.
It's
a title that sometimes people have had trouble getting, if not their tongue, their head around sometimes. But I think you have to set it in the context of the 1990s. And I think some of what John and I thought at the time was that there was an extraordinary focus on what we call the I-squared point of view, and that is people were talking endlessly about information and about individuals, and that these were the two key components that were going to allow us to think about technology in the future. And so we wanted to say, well, it isn't really just about individuals. This stuff takes place, you understand it better in a social context. And so the idea with the title was to draw attention to that. We'd actually written an earlier piece called The Social Life of Documents, trying to say how documents didn't just convey information from one person to another, but again, did their work in a social setting.
So the book I recognize came out, I guess, about 6 years ago. And it seems like maybe you could talk a little bit more about what led up to thinking that this was something that needed to be said and needed to be analyzed.
Well, the 90s were, of course, the great sort of internet boom, and we had the terms which are now slightly faded, but then we were talking about the information society, the information economy, and there were a lot of talk also about disaggregation, the idea that people no longer had to work together, study together, live together, and we all seemed to be going off in the direction it sometimes seemed of little Robinson Crusoe's going to live on our own island, doing our own thing.
Right.
And we thought if you want to know not just how to design better technology, but maybe to understand how some technology gets it wrong, maybe that's the point to begin to be.
The general thesis of the book, what would you say it is?
I think it was that we were living in a time, and I think it's still true now, of an enormous amount of hype. And the question was, how could you see through the hype and really try to understand what was going on underneath? Because there was a great reason for a lot of PR firms to tell us stories. And the simple stories are the nice stories, but they're not always the true stories. We perhaps tried to tell a more complicated story.
The analysis, of course, occurring during the apex of the dot-com boom, does suggest, and in reading the book, it's clear that you are addressing this crowd of people that were talking about retiring at 29 and not having to do anything else with their lives and what have you. But you did say something which I think is a good way to start off getting into the book, which is that the idea is still relevant today in 2006. How relevant do you think it is as we sit here today?
Well, I do think, as others will say, that sometimes there are signs of another boom coming or finishing and a bust heading. And we perhaps shouldn't be too clear about it, but we actually came out just as the market collapsed. I don't think that was our fault, but it did seem that at the time everybody else was giving very sunny predictions, and there was this wonderful book about Dow Jones 30,000 or whatever. And we came along looking a little curmudgeonly at first, I think, when we were in manuscript. But by the time the book came out, people began to say, well, perhaps there are some things that we have got wrong and need to think about. And it may be the case that if, as it is likely, that once again there will be a clear out of some technology companies, that these are lessons that we still need to learn.
Looking back at a book like this, I always think is a lot of fun. And clearly your prognostication skills definitely were far advanced from most people writing about this stuff, because you do talk a little bit about, and maybe you could expand on it, writing the book and the research that you did during a time when the market kept going up. As you discussed this research and you discussed working on this book at the time, do you have any recollections about what it was like to make these points to people that only saw an upside?
Well, certainly there were an awful lot of raised eyebrows, and probably the way that was most clearly delineated was that we were regularly called Luddites.
Right.
That was the term that always got thrown around about anyone who expressed any hesitation about the direction in which things were going. We had the great advantage that both of us were located at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which had a reputation for being very forward-looking, very technologically based. So perhaps people would listen to us a little more. That gave us at least some of a way to overcome the charge of Luddism. But it was around, I can tell you.
The Luddite is one of those terms that is often thrown at anyone that doesn't have anything other than a rosy view of technology. And I do want to ask the question squarely, because I think it's an interesting point. Is your book ultimately a Luddite view of technology? And if not, why?
Well, of course, it's terribly hard to say what's in the reader's eye, and I think some people did and still do read it as Luddism. But I don't actually think it is. I think what we were trying to say was that if you really want to think about technology and where it's good and where it helps us and why we like it, and we are both great technology enthusiasts. My wife always raises a smile at the idea I could be accused of Luddism as I come in with every new gizmo that's available.
Right, right.
You understand the charge, but you want to say, well, if you really want to think about technology, maybe you have to get away from simple cheerleading and think about more complex issues.
Let's talk about some of those issues in the book. And one of the main focuses that you have in the initial part of the book and as a thread that runs through it is the idea of technology somehow attempting to replace relationships between people. Maybe in again, we're limited by time and by a radio show, but in order to crystallize that idea, what point are you trying to make with social life of information and the engineering and its impact on those relationships?
Well, I think one of the standard arguments, because it seems the easiest to make, is an argument about replacement. You say we've got a new technology and it's going to replace the old. And sure enough, you can think of things like 8-track which have gone, and I don't think many people lament it. But what so often happens is actually a new technology comes along and just augments. It adds another possibility. It gives us a different range and scope, but it doesn't necessarily do away with what's gone before. So one of the things we really wanted to try to overcome was that simple idea of replacement, because we thought it was a sort of banal argument that more interesting things could be said if you tried to look at the way that new technologies fitted in with the old.
The new technologies that you were thinking of at the time, what is there a good example that for the listener that would crystallize what the technologies that you viewed were being taken to an extreme and not being considered from their negative impacts?
Well, I think one of the arguments that we made, which has a sort of much longer history and interested us and is once again in the forefront of debate today, was the idea of the death of the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd one that goes right back to the turn of the previous century, to 1910, when people first thought that with the telegraph you could produce an alternative to the newspaper. And what interested us was not so much, you know, whether the technology would prove to be whether the prediction would prove to be true or not, but why so often it was wrong. Why in the 1910s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and all the way up to the 90s, you could always find someone saying, this is the death of the newspaper. And yet the newspaper remained remarkably resilient in the face, even of the Internet.
One of the interesting things that I think we can do with the benefit of hindsight is to consider virtual worlds. And that's an area which obviously didn't exist in the way that we have it today in 2000. People were accessing bulletin boards and things like Prodigy were still, the bulletin board system of posting notes was starting to become a bit archaic, but was still being used. Today, of course, as you know, we have Second Life, we have there.com, where people are indeed leading entire social worlds and running them, controlling them, interacting with them, and indeed the very name Second Life, while certainly presumptuous, does suggest the power that these virtual worlds have. I'm curious, in light of your thesis, do virtual worlds and other more recent forms of social technology in fact enhance the social information that's out there?
Well, I don't want to give away entirely to the idea that the new virtual worlds are entirely new, because in the 90s there were, in fact, and these came out of in part out of Xerox PARC, there were MUDs, multi-user games, and then there were MOOs, which were a sort of a kind of MOO, the multi-user object oriented, they were called. And they were much more tedious in a way, because everything was produced in lines of text. You didn't get the images that you get, but they had many of the features of Second Life, and in fact they were very extensively used, and they were interesting to follow, in part because of the enthusiasm with which people entered those and said this is the wave of the future, and also in part I think because of the political problems that they ran into.
And I take your point. I guess where we are today with the virtual worlds obviously does allow people that are not as technically inclined to engage this technology. And maybe you dispute that point too, so maybe I should ask you to respond to that.
No, I'm not going to dispute that. I agree with you, absolutely.
So where are we left, at least with the virtual world idea? In other words, how much of the virtual worlds, in your estimation, take into account the social life, as you put it, of information that was lacking in a lot of technologies in 2000?
I think they take it in a big way, and I think one of the things I like, although some people say the term is, you know, the name is overweening, but Second Life, you know, does at least assume that there's a First Life going on somewhere else as well. And I think it makes the point I was trying to make earlier, is that these new technologies come along and tend, if they're good, to augment, to add something extra. They don't replace, but they play a role. They make some things easier that we couldn't do in the past. And that seems to be the way that Second Life is emerging.
So you also discussed, and you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to dive into it, the role of documents in organizations. And it's interesting because not only have people predicted the death of newspapers, but people also predicted the death of books and book reader and things like that, where people wouldn't be interested in purchasing a book and holding the book in their hands, but would be reading it through technology. And those, you know, while there is a slow growth in that world, it's still far from anything that approaches a direct threat, in my estimation, to the traditional book printing world. If anything, it's the secondary markets that are impacting them more than anything else. But I'm curious to get your, well, first of all, for the benefit of listeners, really, if you could talk a little bit about how the role of documents and organizations fit into the thesis that you've developed in this book.
Well, because one of the problems that we had around that was that as we both worked for Xerox, that was known as a document company, there were some people thought, well, these are just shilling for the company, these two guys. So we had to overcome that problem, that all they wanted to do is sell more Xerox machines. But it was interesting to us that one of, you know, the basis in part of Xerox's business was very much moving paper around, and why, in the face of other technologies, that proved so resilient. So we looked a lot at the various predictions about the paperless office, which go back to, you know, at least the 60s or 70s, and were often made with Xerox's new technology in mind. And yet they didn't hold up. So there was a question of really what was paper doing around there. One of the other reasons that we wanted to look at the book so much was, of course, many of the predictions made about the Internet would say things like, well, not since the print revolution, et cetera, et cetera. So the question was, you know, why was the print revolution so profound as well?
And you developed that history in a book, and I think it was fascinating to draw those parallels. If you wouldn't mind, in a couple of minutes, tracing that history, I think that would be fascinating.
Well, one of the things about the so-called print revolution is how long, really, many of the things that are called outcomes of the revolution took to fall into place. I mean, we talk about the rise of the Protestant Church or the rise of modern science, but all those really follow by, you know, 100, 200, 300 years from the invention of print itself. So it gave us a little pause that these things, even if they're connected, there's a slow connection before they fall into place. One of the other aspects, of course, was that we were all talking about new kinds of market. And the great thing about the book is it's really the first mass-produced commodity, and it was fairly interesting to think about it in that light rather than in the sort of rather precious way in which people think about early books.
The one of the many glowing visions of the future, and it's something that's written about more and more, are social networks and the idea of networking as being a means by which to capture information but also create new and diverse alternate views of the world and alternate creations that wouldn't otherwise exist, so things like Wikipedia. And what's interesting, and one of the points you make that I want to explore a little bit, is you make the argument in the book that there is definitely a role for more control and indeed organizations using information and creating. Discuss that a little bit, because I think it leads us into some interesting directions.
Yeah, it's I think an important argument and a tricky one, and one that comes up around Wikipedia, where of late I've managed to get myself into trouble with some Wikipedian enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the general argument I might make with the analogy of money, in a sense, when money is made up of gold coins and people more or less know what a good solid piece of gold looks like, you can have an economy built around that doesn't need a lot of institutions. But when you go to paper money and when you go to forms of commerce where money physically never changes hands, you have to start building more and more institutions, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, international banking treaties, and the like. And I think that's one of the odd relations, that as we move into a more digital world, sometimes we're starting to create the need for more and more institutions to sit in the background and keep the system stable. Whereas the standard line, I think, is that the more we move into the digital future, the fewer institutions we will need. And that was one of the paradoxes that we tried to get at in the book.
There have been a number of several authors, certainly since your book was published, that have debunked the notion that information wants to be free. And that's something that is increasingly proven as we take a look at the commodification, for lack of a better word, of technology. I'm curious to get your reaction to that phrase. Does information want to be free?
The phrase is Stuart Brand's, and what has to be fair to him, he hedged his bets pretty well, because in In fact, the next sentence, which usually isn't quoted, is information wants to be expensive.
Ah.
So he was very cleverly having it both ways. One of the questions you always have to ask is whether information is the kind of thing that has wants or desires. But I think one of the problems with that phrase was, if you cut off the second half, it just has this notion that information is a self-supporting, free-floating subject with substance, which will, either occur naturally or will be willing to produce more and more good information without any other structures around it. And I think that was an oversimplification. It had great insight, but it perhaps didn't tell the whole story.
Is there a tandem world that the Wikipedias and the more traditional organizations that control information can traverse? In other words, the Bell Labs model for doing research and development obviously stands in stark contrast with Wikipedia. Where are the synergies, if any, between those two models?
Well, I think you get at an interesting point, and that is, what is, when you have different kinds of peer-to-peer or open-source production, does that exist simply in a vacuum, or are there, again, some kinds of institutions that play a symbiotic role? In one way, you can't really understand Wikipedia without having some notion of the Encyclopedia and the Encyclopedia Britannica. So even while they seem to be competing with each other, one is feeding off and leaning on the other. And I think that one of the challenges as we go forward, and this maybe is a sort of latest obsession in my work, is what are the various different sources or resources that we use to find out the quality of information. There's lots of the stuff out there, and we've been talking about the quantity of information for a decade or more. And now I think we're starting to think, well, what is the quality, and where does quality come from?
The title of my show, Hearsay Culture, gets directly at that idea. As I was thinking about a name for the show, what always struck me about the internet, and it was driven partially by reading your book and others, was the idea that it fell more and more upon the human being to decipher and figure out what it is that they were reading, and to decide for themselves, without any other alternate source of reference, whether that information was worthy of consideration. And your book makes a similar point, and I'm curious to know, and you brought it up, and it's a good time to discuss it, where are we today in our ability to sort through that information?
Well, one thing we know is that the haystack is getting bigger and bigger, and the challenge in many ways is to say, can we still find the needles that we really want in those haystacks? And I think that there are all sorts of different ways. At one end, there are great search tools like Google, but at the other end, there are useful resources which, whether they be universities or newspapers or different kinds of blog, which from the very formal to the informal still provide, as you say, the sort of networks of hearsay that allow us to check, find, and validate information that's around.
The search engine, of course, was something that existed in 2000 and has become a world unto itself, to the point that there are scholars, and in fact, I'll be interviewing one next month, Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School, who's one of several people looking at the issue of whether search engines should be regulated, and if so, how should search results be regulated, and so forth. And the search engine itself, of course, is the means by which most people, maybe virtually all people, and will interact with the internet in one form or another, some exclusively and some not so much. How does the current operation of the search engines, and I'll use Google as our example because it's the most prominent one, impact our ability to make those analyses, in your view?
Well, there's a real challenge for us there, because one thing we know, and I mean, I would swear quite happily, I could barely exist now without Google. It's an enormously important resource. But the more important it becomes, I think there are two challenges. One is, and you've brought this up, and I think it's a word that you're unwise to whisper in the precincts of Google, and that is the phrase public utility.
Mm-hmm.
The old idea that regulation of some sort is needed when something becomes as big and as dominant. So I think that's one problem we face with Google. The other is, of course, that as people try in different ways to fool Google, to push their own pages up the search ranking, Google has to invent more and more elaborate strategies to sense of understanding and seeing whether they're fair and objective becomes less and less likely. And so we get into the odd problem that one of the great things about Google is its apparent transparency. But in order to keep its place in the world, it's going to become more and more opaque, more and more secretive about what it's doing.
That particular tension between secrecy and free flow of information is something that I'm very interested in, and I want to discuss it a little bit. Before we return with Paul Duguid, I do want to ask you what I always ask at the bottom of the hour, which is if you enjoy what you're listening to on KZSU. And hopefully you're enjoying this conversation, but at least you enjoy something about KZSU. And if you love what you're listening to, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, and hearsay culture. By visiting kzsu.stanford.edu and clicking on Donate to KZSU, or emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, you can do your part to make sure our independent sound never dies. So, Paul, let's jump right off from where we were talking about that issue of secrecy. And your argument, I want to push you on a little bit, only to the extent that one could try to use your book as a way to argue that we need more rights and more control over information. In other words, we should put the brakes on a continued run towards freeing up information, freeing up the internet. I know I'm simplifying it, which I'm doing for purposes of the question. So I want to get your reaction to that kind of basic criticism or interpretation of your book.
I see. So now, having put me in the position of a Luddite, I come in arm in arm with the recording industry.
Yeah, exactly. I set you up as the straw man.
Right, here comes the bad guy. It's one of those really tricky questions. If we remove all kinds of controls on information, will the world be better? I think probably not. But does that mean, therefore, every control that we apply inevitably is an improvement? And the answer there is definitely not. So we face one of those very difficult positions where you say, well, have to say, well, if some control, how much and who by? And that, instead of being a nice, easy up or down vote, just becomes a very complex and elaborate discussion. And I think what we were trying really to say in this book is that there are some really complex issues that have to be discussed here and that can't be dismissed in a soundbite saying information wants to be free or, the recording industry of America has it right.
So and of course, as I set you up as the straw man there, I can also go after myself, because one of the things that I often run into when I talk about these issues is people say to me, well, the moment I talk about the idea of social networks, the idea, as we'll discuss in a few minutes, the idea that innovation can in fact occur with less control as opposed to more, people always say to me, the response is, well, are you against copyright? Are you against propertization? Are you against intellectual property? And my response to that is similar to what you've described, because what I ultimately say is no, and we do need the idea of capturing the economic benefits of the work you do, but that there's a delicate balance. And I think that delicate balance is something that your book, so now that I've set you up as a straw man, I will compliment the book so that I keep everyone completely off guard. But in all seriousness, I do think the book really crystallized that conversation, and I think handles it even handedly. And I want to talk about it in light of that discussion, what you mean by the phrase tunnel design, which is a phrase that you use very early on in the book, and again, which is a thread that runs through it.
Well, I think that we were trying to get at a couple of things, and one really does relate quite closely to what we've talked about just now, and that is a sort of linear extrapolation. As we say, well, look, we got from A to B successfully, so let's just continue on exactly the same path. And that's one of the things that really has happened with intellectual property. People say they began by saying, strong intellectual property is good, therefore stronger is better. And those kinds of extrapolations are part of what we think of as tunnel vision. Just look straight ahead and ignore the collateral damage along the way. And we were trying to say that if you really want to see how things in the past have moved from success to success or failed. It's whether they've been able to adjust to circumstances that change as you move along that path. And tunnels shouldn't always go in one straight line.
How much of the technology that you were thinking of at the time did you view at the time as being tunnel design?
Well, I think that some of the things that you've mentioned on the show so far, which really didn't have a lot of prominence at the time, the kinds of social software that we think of now, didn't really have much of a place back then. As I say, an awful lot of it really was focused on individuals and freeing or liberating the individual, in particular liberating them from social connections. And that, I think, has turned out, not just by our prediction, but by the way that some software has emerged, really not to be what's successful. What has been good has been the software that has linked people socially together and allowed them to create and develop these networks.
And in the intervening years, I take it you would say that more and more of the design structures of technology are less tunnel design and more focused on those human interactions.
I think that might make me over-optimistic.
Okay.
I think, you know, there are areas where it's great, where you see things like wikis and other kind of social software expanding. But if you look, for instance, at some of the corporate software that is being developed, it seems sometimes more and more draconian, more and more telling people there's only one way in which they can work, one set of rules to which they have to be responsible. Things like RFID tags and the like seem to me to be denying many of the sort of social insights that we've got in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an upside and a downside, I think.
As we're having this conversation, an interesting, very new search engine occurs to me, and I kind of want to get your reaction to it. So Microsoft has come out with this search engine called Miss Dewey, which is a Flash-based search engine where an actress who stands basically as a visual representation of the search engine throws out various comments and makes various facial gestures and hand gestures and what have you as you type in your search query and in fact will egg you on to type something if you haven't, and it has all of these, I mean, from my estimation, bizarre qualities to it. I don't know if you had the opportunity to take a look at it, but I guess the broader question is the search engine that attempts to have in it some idea of artificial intelligence or some kind of emotional interaction with the user, reaction to that.
Well, I've only had a glance at it, and of course it throws everybody back to remembering the dreaded Microsoft paperclip that used to chase you around
right,
the screen.
Right.
And we thought, well, maybe we put that to rest, and it comes back again in an even flashier form. But it's the revenge of the paperclip. Bob is back, I think. But I think there are significant issues there. One, actually, just side issue is interesting, is that to run a website with a lot of Flash in it is not only, in a small technical point, a huge sort of burden on some systems, but it's intriguingly one of the things that search engines themselves can't deal with very well is pages with Flash in them. So it's odd that they should be promoting them. But
right.
I think that one of the issues is that you do want to have some sense of, you know, how to refine a search. And one of the things that frustrates search engine designers is how crude some of the questions people ask. And I don't mean sexually crude here.
Right.
I simply mean, you know, they're not very well refined. But on the other hand, trying to automate how people, you know, how you get people to respond doesn't work very well. And as you say, one of the things they're trying to produce is some kind of emotional response. And my hunch at the moment is that emotional response will be anger.
And in fact, along those lines, one of the funny, I don't have it in front of me, but one of the commentators analyzing this website pointed out that when the designers have to put a mute button on it and give you a mute option, that should tell you that they designed something annoying.
Right.
So it was kind of an interesting comment on it.
That's exactly right.
We have about 10 minutes left in the conversation. I do want to, your book has so many different topics in it. Unfortunately, we can only scratch the surface of most of them. But I do want to touch on the idea of disruptive innovation. That's a term that Henry Chesbro, who wrote the book Open Innovation and who will be on the show, will be airing an interview I did with him in early January, has coined the idea of innovation being and technologies actually throwing off our view of the world and altering the way we view and interact with the world. What, in a nutshell, what do you see as the primary destabilizing effect of technology on people?
Well, I think it goes two ways. I mean, I'd be, you know, my response to Hank Chesbro, who I think is a great writer and, of course, wrote a wonderful book about Xerox PUC, where I was associated.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, one of the things that I think he brings out very nicely in some ways is the way in which users themselves tend to turn products around, turn innovations around, and really make them useful in ways that their original inventors didn't think would happen. And, of course, that suggests to me that it isn't really the technology that's shaking up the world only, but it's also the world that's shaking up the technology. And there's a nice interaction there, that if we start to say, well, it's technology that disrupts society, you get technology as in the lead position and society is merely this bunch of people that follow along. I think the picture, as I read him, that he tells is a much more interesting one, which says, you know, the technology comes out there and people then play around with this technology, and the people who designed the technology in the first place can even be quite surprised. And we know this from the telephone and the radio and how people thought they would work in the world. Users suddenly push back at this stuff and say, no, this is really what's interesting about it. You've got it wrong, you know, and let's go in this direction. So you see very interesting, but I think slightly more complex interactions than the tagline, which is sort of disruptive technology.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, and it does draw into that distinction that I've been discussing a little bit, which is the distinction between innovation that's driven by control and innovation that's driven by sharing. And I use those terms, you know, very loosely, of course, but they kind of set the dichotomy apart. I do want to ask you about another interesting definitional issue that you discuss in your book, which is the distinction between knowledge and information. How would you define those two terms in light of your book and today?
Now, that's a question that I think I spent 10 years avoiding. So if you think you can pin me down the last 10 minutes. Yeah.
Darn.
But I think, let me try and say a couple of words, because I think it gets a lot of people in a tussle. Uh-huh. One of the tricky things about information, and true about knowledge as well, but because information has become such a prevalent term, is that it has a bundle of different uses. There's a really heavily sort of scientific use of it, and it goes back to people like Shannon and Weaver who in their mathematical theory of communication, talked about this notion of information. But they said that's a notion to which the concept of meaning doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you say that, you're really not talking about what you and I mean when we talk about information. And then there's economists who talk about information and talk about a concept of perfect information. And you and I probably don't have much of an idea of what perfection means. And then there's a sort of run-of-the-mill use of information, is the sort of stuff that we write down or, you know, type into our computers. And then there's a notion of information that can look really very much and almost be interchangeable with some notions of knowledge. And then knowledge tends to be this rather more personal concept. You know, I can ask you to give me the information you have, but it's pretty odd to ask you to give me the knowledge you have. Knowledge is not something that you can pass up and down the phone line. So there's a lot of little distinctions both within the word information and within the word knowledge. I think we only get confused when we try to say, you know, when we move too rapidly from one notion of information to the other, that when we talk about, on the one hand, the scientific or economistic use of the term, and pretend that that is similar to the term that people are using in everyday language.
You know, there's an interesting irony there, which is that technology, of course, has to be designed and coded very specifically and with very specific uses of terms, and you don't have as much flexibility in deciding what word you're going to use to type in code. And yet when we talk about these issues, I agree with you that these terms are thrown around wildly and no one has a clear idea of what they really mean when they say it. And the word information, I mean, is similar to the phrase information superhighway, which you don't hear much anymore either, because no one really knew what that meant either. And it ultimately led to, in many ways, unproductive discussions as opposed to discussions and analysis that, that would at least advance our understanding of what they mean. Is it leads to a general question, which I, which I'd like to get your reaction to, which is precision. How much precision do you think is, and by precision I mean detailed and really non-breezy, non-glib discussion of where we are in technology exists today as compared to when you wrote the book?
Well, yeah, certainly not something I feel I can be precise about. I mean, the landscape has changed a good deal, clearly, and is changing with extraordinary rapidity. And so, in a way, anyone is a mug or else, you know, selling hype who likes to put down a long-term prediction. But I think that we have seen, as I suggested earlier, a real shift, and it's something that you brought up in discussion and in the name of your show, is that we really are starting to think much more now about networks and social networks. And we start to think about technology and get interested in technology and the way that it helps and supports and enhances those networks. And I think that's a real improvement in our way of thinking, because we've almost forgotten, I think, how individualistic and unsocialized our talk about technology was 10 years ago. And I'm not sure that's going to be able to tell us where we're going to be in 5 years' time, but I still think it probably means it'll be easier to get where we are in 5 years' time without quite so much wasted time and energy.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I've asked you, I'd say, probably three or four questions that are borderline unfair, and of course, I, you know, because I've asked the crystal ball questions, and what I've told other people when I've asked those questions is, of course, as formerly a litigator, people would always say, are we going to win the case? And of course, you know, the response is, well, I don't have a crystal ball. I'll tell you what I think the likely outcomes are. So I'm certainly not holding you to, any hard and fast predictions of where we're headed or where we're likely to go. And I promise you that I won't attempt to call you on it in the future, although I may point out if you were right.
Well, you should note there's the clash of titans here. There's the litigator asking hard questions on the one side, but there's the academic who's used to years of dodging questions
right,
on the other end.
Right, exactly. And that's the classic battle, you know, in the profession. So, you know, and your point, but your last point about where we are, I mean, it brings to mind an anecdote that I have, which is from my own experience. At the same time that you were thinking about this book and doing the research, I was in law school, and I did, so I'm saying roughly 1997, 98, and I went to Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, which has an enormous engineering background and has a heavy focus on placing students into, you know, postgraduate programs in engineering and science and what have you. And one of the requirements there, which was cutting edge at the time, but which is now more common, is that students did have to come in with whatever was the state-of-the-art computer, so that they could access the network, which was far more, the school was far more networked than most schools at the time. The interesting thing was I was a resident director of an undergraduate dormitory. I guess residence hall is the phrase that was used. And what I was shocked by was the fact that I would have students who would be sitting in the same room and emailing each other, as opposed to rotating their chair or talking to them, you know, in the cafeteria or what have you. And this wasn't just some people. I wouldn't say it was a huge number, but it was more than a few who were emailing each other either while they were in the same room or certainly where they would see each other, you know, 10 minutes later if they just waited in the room. And that was kind of the desocializing impact of technology that startled me and really caused me to take a step back. And I think your book does make those similar points that we need to be more conscious of those thoughts. In the few minutes that we have left, I do want to talk to you about this where are we headed question and at least get some of your thoughts and bounce them around. I could ask a simple question of where are we headed, but I'll make it a little more specific and therefore I think a little bit more fair by asking it this way. The virtual worlds that we discussed earlier as a crucible for people using technology in a new way. My sense is that they're only going to grow and more people are going to get used to them. But I'm curious to get your reaction in talking to students and you teach a course up at Berkeley. How, as you meet with students, how comfortable are they with these uses of technology that address very squarely the concerns that you raised in your book?
Well, in some ways I think, and this is a wide concern, concern is that they're almost too comfortable with them. Hmm. That these things are new and they like them and they go in there, and I think we're now starting to learn that people are, you know, putting out information that it's unwise to put out about themselves, that they're not asking some of the right questions about privacy, about what will happen to this stuff which may be stored beyond their control, used by people without their knowledge. So while I think on the one hand there's, you know, what's remarkable is if you look at young people, the alacrity with which they can move between different kinds of communication and say, well, look, this is, you know, for a text message, this is for email, this is for telephone, this is for MySpace, this is for, you know, writing on paper. Their way of carving up the communicative space gets richer and richer and richer, and they have very fine distinctions between when you send an email and when you send a text message. But I think that on the other hand, you know, there are some reflective questions about this stuff. Particularly as they're being, you know, bought by corporations and you're not quite sure who's going to deal with the archives and how, that perhaps they need to ask more about. So there's advantages and there's questions, I think.
If I was able to get a 3-hour block for the show, I would destroy all of my guests and myself, with a 3-hour conversation. Unfortunately, while I certainly invite you back, if you're interested, if I don't hear the phone slam down at this point, I'll know at least I have a shot, to discuss these issues, further in the spring or in the summer. So before we end, I do want to ask you, for people that want to learn more about this topic in this area, do you have any suggestions?
Well, there is an old and slightly dated website now called thesociallifeofinformation.com, which has stuff about the book, and I actually am only bringing this up now because it puts an implication or an obligation on me to update the site, which has languished a little. And that does have some ties to other writings that John and I have done since then and emerging work which might be of interest.
Well, I look forward to following that work, and I want to thank you again, Paul Duguide, the co-author of the book Social Life of Information out of Harvard Business School Press, for being here today on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for taking the time.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure, and that was a great question. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I want to thank again Paul Duguide, the co-author of the book Social Life of Information, for being on today. It's always fun for me and hopefully for you to hear from authors who wrote books more recently or less recently than a year ago and be able to see where those books have brought us and certainly to discuss their continued relevance. And certainly his book is one of those. So we have a number of shows coming up. For those of you that are interested in where the schedule's headed, I do encourage you to go to my blog, which I've used more recently to basically post my schedule for Hearsay Culture, but you can find the blog by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and there you can also learn a lot about what's happening at CIS, the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, where I'm a resident fellow, and all of the fascinating things that are going on there and the great people that are associated with it. You can also find this show. Many of you are listening to it on iTunes, and you can come across it there. So next week, I look forward to talking to Balazs Bodo, who is a Fulbright research scholar at CIS, on the impact of technology on opening up doors to knowledge in Europe and his experience researching and looking at these issues. The show will be live, so it will be one of the minority of shows that I've done live. This show is being recorded on December 14th, the day that it's being aired, and I do my best to try to record the shows as close to the air date as possible. And I do hope that you'll continue listening. I will be taking off the week between Christmas and New Year's to take some vacation with my wife. And then I'll be returning in January with a schedule, which you can find on the webpage. And I'm looking forward to a great lineup of guests focusing on the wide range of issues that we discuss on Hearsay Culture. So thank you for listening today. Please continue to stay tuned to the great programming on KZSU. And thanks for listening.